Lemonada.
Hi, I'm Amy Donaldson, host of The Letter. As I was reporting and researching this podcast, a few questions came up repeatedly. One of those was, why is grief so misunderstood? I've had my own struggles with the guilt and shame associated with grief, and so I reached out to author and grief therapist, Claire Bidwell-Smith, in hopes of having a conversation about one of society's most taboo topics. Claire is a renowned grief expert who has written several books on the topic, offers online programs, and hosts the podcast New Day from Lemonada. Claire and I discussed a wide range of issues associated with grief, like why we act like grief is something we should get over or move on from, why guilt is so often associated with grief, and how our fear of grief causes more pain and isolation for those struggling with loss. My hope is that we can offer some insight and practical help, not just for those struggling with grief, but for those who want to provide comfort to the grieving. Thank you for listening. I guess I just wanted to start with how you got into grief counseling. Like, what drew you to study or to work in this field?
It was not what I thought I wanted to be when I grew up. I'll tell you that. I was always a writer as a kid. But when I was 13, both of my parents got cancer at the same time. My mother had colon cancer and my father had prostate cancer. And I'm an only child. It was a lot for our little family. My mom died when I was a freshman in college. And then my father died 7 years later, right after I finished college. And, you know, their deaths just rocked my world and kind of forced me into a place that none of my peers were in at the time. You know, in our early 20s, all my peers were doing post-college life, and I was reckoning with really big questions, not just about end of life and grief and these existential things, but kind of like end of life care and death and dying and grief in general and how our culture treats it and views it and accommodates it. And so I ended up getting my master's in clinical psychology and working in hospice initially. And then I have now been in private practice for over a decade as a grief therapist.
So did you have any reservations studying this or going into this, or did it help you with your grief to actually sort of be pursuing it professionally?
I had no reservations. It did help, but I also had to do a lot of personal work before I was at the point where I could go back and get my master's and kind of dive into it. But what I really found and saw going through it myself was just a real lack of support and understanding in our culture for how we deal with grief, how we think about it, how we support it, how we make space for it. And so I really, that's where I had no reservation. I felt like if someone like me is this comfortable with grief, then I really want to get out there and help other people move through it and help change our culture around it.
Why do you think we have this kind of fundamental misunderstanding about what grief is? Because it seems like it's like an affliction that you get and you're supposed to get over it. Why is that? Why do we view it that way? And is that an American or Western idea, or what do you think?
Some of it is definitely Western. There are other cultures who really embrace grief in different ways, embrace end of life, embrace elder care. Western culture, not so much. I think we have a really big fear of death. I think that we've very much medicalized death. And so we're not seeing it in the home. We're not participating in end of life in ways that maybe we were 100 years ago. And so I think that's a big part of it. People really don't want to face death. They don't want to talk about it. They're scared to talk about it with people who have gone through it. Like, it might be contagious.
So where does this idea though come from that you need to get over it? Like I heard this, actually just heard this recently, someone saying, you know, when you have a baby, people don't say like, you're so happy about having a baby. Like, when are you going to be over that joy, right? Mm-hmm. When are you going to be finished with this joyous process?
Yeah.
But I think we look at it as this process, this thing we have to go through, this thing we have to do, and that there's some kind of end. Where does that come from? And why is that so damaging to people who are actually dealing with grief?
I think it stems from that fundamental fear, you know? So if I am someone who's watching someone else go through grief, that's scary for me to think about that it would never end, right? So I want them to get over it so that it makes me feel better about the idea of if I ever have to go through a big loss, that I would be able to get over it too. So I think we push each other to move through it. But the reality is, you don't get over some losses, you know, a lot of losses. We never get over them. We learn to live with them in our lives, and we learn to kind of incorporate them into our narrative and into our daily existence, but we don't get over them.
Yeah, where does this idea of closure come from? You know, I lost my stepdaughter in 2013, and my kids decided they wanted to spread our ashes at a favorite place in Hawaii. And one of my stepsons kept saying to me, like, you know, we need closure. We need to do this. We need to have this act, right? And I just felt the need to say to him, like, for a parent, there's no closure. Like, there isn't any. This won't end anything. Mm-hmm. This will be something we do to honor Jill or her memory, but it's not. But that experience alone just made me wonder, like, where does this idea of closure come from, and why is it so? It drives so much of what we, mm-hmm. so much that surrounds grief.
Yeah, I think closure is a myth. I think some of it, again, stems from that fear, you know, that just the desire that there could be closure, that there might be an end to this kind of pain and agony that you go through. And then some of it does stem from the older school of grief literature. You know, the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross 5-stage model kind of has that final stage, which is acceptance, and kind of lends itself to the idea that there maybe should be closure. And we've very much in the last 20 years moved on. I still love Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and love her pioneering of this work and field. But I think she did end up creating some ideas that are now outdated, but that a lot of people still turn towards. You know, there's still some of the most well-known information out there is coming from the work she began.
Why do you think grief feels so shameful? Like, why does it feel like something you should be embarrassed about or that you should not admit?
I think it's that reaction you get. I mean, people are just really scared of grief and death. So when you tell someone that you've gone through a big loss, the way that they react to you gives you that sense of shame. And often they react by telling you should be over it, not wanting to talk about it, giving you these kind of platitudes like, well, everything happens for a reason, or, you know, God only gives you as much as you can handle. These ideas that people will say to you give you that immediate sense that whatever you are feeling is not correct. And then with that comes shame.
The other thing that is puzzling to me about grief is, why do we compare so much? Why is there this need to, like, I noticed this during COVID. Well, I can't be sad because my track season got canceled because people are dying, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's sort of this, do you deserve to grieve idea? And I where does that come from?
The grief Olympics, the grief shaming. I saw a lot of it during COVID as well. Yeah, other people would be telling you, well, you should be grateful that you have A, B, and C because these other people are going through a harder time. It's that lack of self-compassion we carry for ourselves. It's the lack of making space for vulnerability, the kind of toxic positivity that we see sometimes. That was a lot of what I saw during COVID as well. And when we do that, it really invalidates someone's experience. It takes away from what they're feeling. We get to grieve all kinds of things. We grieve throughout our lifetimes on a regular basis. We grieve homes we lived in. We grieve jobs we lose. We grieve illnesses and our health that we may go through. We grieve divorces, pets, you know, so many things we can grieve and we should grieve for. But our culture often wants to kind of tidy those things up and not really allow the space they deserve.
So how do we shift that in our culture? Like, do we just keep talking about it, keep doing it? I mean, what changes that?
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely have to keep talking about it. You know, for as much grief shaming as I saw during COVID, I also saw some really big fundamental shifts. I did see a new awareness and recognition that we do grieve for a lot of things. And I've been talking about grief and writing about it for years. And this was the first time that I saw people really hungry for information about it, wanting to talk about it, news outlets wanting to cover it, wanting to explore it, articles being shared about grief and all the different facets of it. So I do feel heartened that we made some leaps during these last few years in terms of recognizing how real grief is, how important it is, how long it lasts. And I think as long as we continue talking about it and continue providing examples of what it really looks like to grieve, then we can make some strides.
Are you familiar with survivor's guilt, or have you dealt with that in some of your therapy?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Where does that come from?
I think that really comes from just the absolute pain of being the one that's here. You know, I think you see it a lot in accidents. I think you see it in child loss. You know, it's just that unbearable wanting to almost take the place of that person, so that it's so hard to bear that pain and just wanting to, especially, you know, in the loss of a child, just have them still be here. You'd almost rather be gone than have them be gone. You know, I think that that's very real and very understandable, but it's hard to bear.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the case of our podcast, you know, it extends for decades, right? Mm-hmm. So, and some of it, I wondered if it wasn't connected to like, more and more we're dealing with like random acts of violence, you know, mass mm-hmm. shootings, which are, you know, there's just this sort of, I don't know, just sort of luck of the draw situation, mm-hmm. right? Why me and not them, right?
Yeah.
And have you seen kind of that role, and like what role does that play, and like how do you help people not feel bad that they were the lucky one?
I think guilt is a very interesting concept in grief. When we look at guilt in grief, it's something that many, many people feel. One of my favorite Elizabeth Kubler-Ross quotes is that guilt is perhaps grief's most painful companion, because it is so common. And I think that one of the things that I really see with guilt is that the feeling that if you were to let go of feeling guilty, if you were to stop feeling guilty, then maybe that means you're over it. So guilt almost becomes a way of holding on to the person, holding on to the grief, holding on to just any form of not letting this be okay. And so what I do in my work often is to encourage people to find new ways to hold on to their person, new ways to honor them that maybe aren't tied to guilt. You know, what are some new ways you can create a connection or relationship internally or spiritually with the person you lost, rather than having to hold on to them through the form of guilt? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Why do you think it is we focus so much on like the endings, right? The end of someone's life, how things, mm-hmm. when there could be 80 great years, right? You know, mm-hmm. I don't know. I just find it interesting that just that sometimes that focus stays on the tragedy or just the end or just, you know.
I think sometimes, most of the time, we're just not prepared for it. Someone could die of a long illness and we're still not prepared for it, you know, because we have this cultural inability to face it. So we're not preparing for it. What I have seen in cases where someone is very consciously moving into death and end of life, and a family is really embracing it, say they're working with death doulas or hospice or palliative care, there's a difference there. They're not focusing so much on the end after the person is gone. They are able to think more about the life and feel gratitude for the time spent because they did do the work to face the death. But when we don't do that work, I think we do focus on it a lot. We think about what we could have done differently, how we could have prevented it, all the things that led up to it. There's that just kind of searing agony of like, how, why did this happen? And it's hard to let go of that. And I think it just comes from not being prepared or having faced it.
We'll be right back after this break. So anyone who knows me knows that one of my missions in life is finding clothing that is professional and comfortable. But when it comes to fashion, I am, shall we say, wardrobe challenged. And that's why I am so excited to tell you about Quince. Quince has given those of us who've worked from home for so long, we have no idea what's actually in style anymore, help and hope. I am anxiously awaiting delivery of my Black Mongolian cashmere crew neck sweater. It's just $50. And my adorable olive linen jumper. Quince makes it easy to find stylish, high-quality items, even on a journalist budget. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than you'd find with similar luxury brands. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/theletter for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/theletter to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/theletter.
What are some ways you tell people to grieve better? I mean, I think one of the things that's hard about grief is that it feels bad, you know, and it feels heavy, and it's, you know, uncomfortable and sad. And I get tired sometimes of being sad and tired.
Yeah.
I think we've all felt that a little bit during the pandemic, right? Like we all have a taste of what it would be like to live with like long-term grief and loss and disconnection, you know? And so I just wonder if there's ways to do it better. I mean, I've heard a lot of advice about, you know, get your mind, you know, like sort of redirect, do something different. And then other people are saying, no, sit with your, let yourself be sad. Like I went to counseling and I listed off all the things I was sad about. And my counselor said, well, those sound like really good reasons to be sad. So you should just be sad. And it had not occurred to me to just be sad. It was like, how do I get over feeling sad about these things or upset or frustrated or whatever? And I think we're just having a hard time, like, how do we do this well? So that you don't sit in it and be mired in it and stay stuck there, but also you have to feel it and you have to be okay with the fact that you're going to feel it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's both of those things, right? It's like allowing yourself to really sit with it. It's so uncomfortable. And we're not good at sitting with uncomfortability. We're not good at sitting with uncertainty. We're a culture that tries anything to avoid pain and discomfort. So we're very good at it. So it's a natural inclination to kind of want to get away, especially from that kind of pain. It is exhausting. It's consuming. It touches every part of your life. You know, why wouldn't you want to fight that? I get it. But I do think that, you know, that old adage, the only way out is through, we have to sit with it. We have to be in it in order to move through it. And so doing that, but also, you know, there's a term called resilient grieving, which is grieving, but still moving forward and putting things in place, maybe using distraction in some ways, maybe rebuilding your life in others, yet still allowing that balance and that space to grieve. So that's one idea. I think it's also very personality-based, you know? It really depends on how we do things. Like Sheryl Sandberg, Facebook CEO, when she lost her husband and wrote her book about grief, but she's a very type A person, right? So she was the kind of person that when she went through that loss, she was like, how do I get right on top of this thing and like move through it? That's not how everybody is. Some of us, you know, run more melancholy or thoughtful or internal or private or public. And so we all grieve the way we do anything. So kind of figuring out how you move through that is very personal, but also just, you know, allowing that space for it.
What are ways you give people to support other people? So if you know someone who's suffered a really significant loss and or they've been grieving for a while, like how do you help them and how do you not take it personally when it doesn't cure them?
There's only so much you can do. I mean, I wish that we could carry people's grief sometimes. You know, I think this like image in my head of just carrying someone's backpack for a little while down a path, I wish we could just pick it up for someone, and we can't really, but we can be there and we can show up and we can continue to let them know that we're there and we'll sit with them in it rather than shut it down or try to tidy it up or try to make it positive, you know, just showing up and sitting there with them in it, doing anything you can just to be helpful in their lives. You know, as you know, going through grief, it's very consuming. Having someone just come over and take the garbage out is great, you know, bring you a meal. One thing I always say is like, keep checking in with that person months, years down the road. It matters. The grief isn't gone. Everybody always shows up in the first 6 weeks, right? And then it's sometimes the 6 month mark when you're just really hitting rock bottom. And yet everyone's like, oh, aren't you better now? No, keep checking in with them. Keep giving them space to grieve long, long ways down the road.
And do you think it's harder because it's not really a straight line? Like it's not, you don't go from like, oh, I'm really sad. Oh, now I'm better. Right. So it's a, today you feel better and tomorrow I'll feel terrible again. is it the roller coaster of it that makes it even more difficult, not only to experience, but also like to help somebody because you just don't know.
You just don't know. Yeah. I think the grieving person themselves doesn't know how they're going to feel 1 hour to the next. You know, you could be fine in the morning and then you're walking across the kitchen and you drop to your knees in grief out of nowhere. So it is hard to know what to expect. And that can cause anxiety. It can be very disruptive to your life. And so as we support people through that, I think we have to be also prepared for anything, you know, to meet them where they are. I always say rather than grief shaming, we should be grief curious, you know, ask people how they're doing. What is your experience like? Tell me, I don't know, you know, let me help open space for that.
That's an interesting idea. But again, it's the fear, I guess, the fear that it will become your pain. The reason people shy away from that, or they're afraid of saying the wrong thing, I guess.
People just like to fix things, you know. We want to help and we want to make things better. And you can't always make someone's grief better. You can't fix it. You can't fix what has happened, and you can't make them feel better. And maybe they don't need to feel better. They just need to be supported while they go through this pain. But we really like to fix things, and we get frustrated when we can't.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the inability to fix things means the inability to end grief. So I'm 53 and I've just barely heard this idea that grief is love. And I loved this idea because I feel like when you think of it that way, then you understand why it's always going to be with you in some mm-hmm. form.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely is. I mean, it's a reflection of love, right? It's a reflection of a relationship. And so that grief, however you're feeling it, however long you're feeling it, it's a reflection of that time that you spent with that person, the love you had for them, the way they impacted your life. You wouldn't expect somebody to feel nothing after such a significant relationship, you know? Some people have complicated grief too. Some people had complicated relationships. It wasn't all love. It wasn't, you know, all highs. There were some lows there too. So they're sometimes grieving the relationship they could have had. There's so many layers of grief and ways we have to move through it.
I guess it's because we're complicated, right?
We are complicated creatures.
Do you think that the experience of the last couple of years with the pandemic, that's going to make us more cognizant? I mean, because everyone's suffering grief. Everyone suffers grief. Like, this is not something mm-hmm. you're going to escape. It's going to happen to you in some form at some point, right? But do you think that's made us more aware of just how it is everybody? It's not just you. You're not isolated in your silo.
Yeah, I hope so. But I think somebody told me that they had this thought at some point during the pandemic that one of the most difficult things was that we all were grieving. And so usually we kind of can take turns. You know, someone's grieving while we're doing okay, so we can help them through it. And then when we're grieving, they can show up for us. But at this time when we were all grieving, it was a little difficult to show up for each other because we were all kind of wrapped up in what we were going through. But that also, on the flip side, had this effect of really understanding what everybody was going through and you know, giving them permission and space because you understood and were going through it too.
Any other advice for people, like people who are struggling or suffering themselves or who want to help somebody that they care about?
Mm-hmm. I think just like letting yourself be curious, giving yourself permission to feel everything that's coming up for you. I can't tell you how many clients have come to my office and said, I think I'm doing this wrong. There's no wrong way to grieve. You know, there really isn't. It's so individual, but it's also a lot bigger than people expect. Be compassionate with yourself. Be kind with yourself as you let yourself grieve. You know, ask for help and support. Reach out and help and support others who are going through it, even if you don't understand what they're going through. Just showing up for them and telling them that you're here is more than enough sometimes.
I wanted to jump in here and give you some context for this next bit of discussion. I was just about to end the interview when producer Andrea Smartin asked a question that speaks to the very core of why we wanted to tell the story of the letter.
What about the fact that we're doing this podcast and bringing out all these stories?
Yeah. My guilt.
We've questioned ourselves, why are we making people go through this? You know? Yeah. So maybe about the value of telling the stories.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That's a good point, Andrea. I'm just trying to hide my own shame. No, I have had a lot of moments where I wondered whether or not this was a good idea, whether or not talking about this podcast and talking about the ideas in this podcast and really their story, their journey through this terrible thing and to the places that they are now, both of them are in good places. But I have had a lot of guilt about, is it worth going back to this painful thing and painful events and such a terrible loss, and then dragging them through all the stuff that in between the last 26 years, what is the value to going back and reliving this tragedy and all the things that came after it?
I mean, I think mostly on the level that we were talking about earlier, which is, you know, how do we change the culture around grief? How do we change the culture around death and our understanding of it? And we do have to talk about it, and we do have to share these stories. Nobody wants to read about it in a textbook. They want to hear the personal stories of how this unfolded and what the ripple effects were and what the journey was like. I think it does help a lot of people out there who may be going through something similar. I think it helps people who've never been through it just kind of understand a little more about grief and death. So I think there is a lot of value in it, but I can understand your hesitation or just moments of wondering of what's going on with this for you. But I think ultimately, I do think it can be just so incredibly healing to be putting stories like this out there.
Claire Bidwell-Smith is a grief counselor and host of the podcast New Day, available from Lemonada, and at her website, clairebidwellsmith.com. I've introduced Claire to Cy Snar, Zachary Snar's mother, the young man who was killed in the podcast. So if you follow New Day, it's possible you'll catch Cy on a guest appearance. The Letter is researched and reported by me, Amy Donaldson. It's written by myself and Andreas Martin, who is also responsible for production and sound design. Mixing by Trent Sell, with KSL Podcasts, executive producer Cheryl Worsley. For Lemonada Media, executive producers Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittles Wax. And executive producers Paul Anderson and Nick Pinella with Workhouse Media. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com and on social at The Letter Podcast. The Letter is produced by KSL Podcasts and Lemonada Media in association with Workhouse Media.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Feeling decision fatigue about what to make for dinner? We get it. I'm Jane Black.
And I'm Liz Dunn. We're veteran food journalists, and as parents ourselves, we know how hard it can be to feed your family.
That's why we created Pressure Cooker, a podcast that offers practical strategies for navigating the marketing madness and cultural expectations around mealtime.
Each week, we'll check in with the experts. From social media diet trends to baby-led weaning and AI meal planning, we have all your food-related questions covered.
Listen to Pressure Cooker wherever you get your podcasts.